As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Surveillance. I'm Shanali Basak, and joining me now is Ken Mollis, CEO of Mollis & Company. Thank you so much for joining us, Ken.
Shanali, great to be here.
So you've been on a world tour. You just came back from Russia, where you had a panel with Putin. What was the big takeaway?
Well, it was interesting. You know, it's hard to get good information, and you do these things because my job is to get as much information about the global economy as you can. So there was a lot of takeaways about it, just getting up to speed on the Moscow economy and how the sanctions are affecting and what they're doing. So I thought it was good to put that information in the back of your mind and keep it in mind as you're advise companies.
Are they the next place for you to be doing the next big deal?
No. Russia is a long, I think it's a while in the future. But look, it's a long life. I've been doing this 40 years. And, you know, friends last a long time, loyalties, you get to know people. Look, it's a long time, I think, before an American company will be, Russia will be investable. But someday, maybe.
You were also recently spending a lot of time in Hong Kong with the Hong Kong Stock Exchange proposed takeover of the London Stock Exchange. What is the tone there right now? Are you worried about what's going on there?
You know, I've been around the world a lot. I haven't been to Hong Kong in a while. But look, what's happening in Hong Kong is definitely concerning. But again, the world, it's getting to be, I think what happened with Trump and the China and the trade war calming down will be positive. And again, things are long. There's a lot of issues. You go back over, again, I've been doing this 40 years. There's always been major issues. But we tend to get through these. And actually, business is one of the key events that keeps peace and things moving in the world. People in business want to do transactions with each other, want to get to know each other. And it kind of supersedes the cycle of almost politics.
By the way, with so much time in Russia and China right now, what does that say about where you think power is shifting in the world?
Well, again, don't overdo Russia. I was there for a brief time to, you know, to get some information. Look, there's obviously China's important, but, you know, it's interesting. We're just thinking about the United States was 23% of world GDP 10 years ago. And if you would have bet that the United States would have been larger or smaller, given the rise of the BRICS and all those economies, I think we're up to 25%. So there's a lot of hand-wringing in the United States, but we went from 23 to 25% of world GDP. The U.S. has great laws, it's got great capital markets, it's got innovation, it's still a tremendous place.
When you listen to Trump speak this week, and you know Trump, right? You've worked with Donald Trump before. How are world leaders receiving his message here in Davos?
Well, look, they receive it in different ways. But I think the thing that he did do, that President Trump did when he got here, was at least very carefully tell the story, and it's hard to get it sometimes, that the U.S. economy is booming. We do have 3% unemployment. There are so many good things going on. We are deregulating. There are lots of things in the policies that are generating substantial rewards for business and people and for everybody. And I know sometimes you can get caught up in the tweets and the presentations, but if you really, and I think he did a good job of just calming that down and saying, look what we're accomplishing. And I do think the policies have been good for business.
What do you think his prospects are, given that you called his last election? What do you think his prospects are for this upcoming one?
Well, look, it's too early to tell. We don't have a candidate. You know, in order to call a good fight, you have to know who the other side is. So I'm going to wait on that. I think there's lots to go in the primaries, and Lots of stories to be told over the next 6 or 7 months. So I'll wait. Let's wait and see who it's between.
The other thing that everyone's talking about here in Davos, at least publicly, is sustainability and green initiatives. But three times just today, I've had bankers tell me that we're talking about green too much here. And so I'm kind of wondering what you're hearing. What do you think is the opportunity, or is it realistic for the financial industry and BlackRock, which is leading the charge here, to make real change?
So that's a complicated question. And let me say this. Look, we have to advise our clients on how to navigate in an environment where, look, ESG and all and environment's going to be part of what they're held accountable for. Now, does sometimes Davos go overboard on some of the requirements and things that they're talking about? Sure. People ask me why I go to Davos, and I say sometimes to find out exactly what the consensus is so I know what won't happen. and do the opposite. Because, you know, it's an extremely consensus atmosphere here. And but look, people are going to have to deal with the fact that large institutions like BlackRock and like rating agencies and government institutions will be monitoring certain environmental, social, governance checklist, and we're going to have to help our clients through that.
Well, you advised Aramco. Where does that fit into the situation here?
Look, the world is going to continue to use and need cheap energy. You know, there's 500 million Europeans, there's 300 million Americans, 350. There's 6 or 7 billion people in the world who still are struggling. And the access to cheap fossil fuels, it's their life. You know, India, China, Africa, they're not as worried about the environment yet as they are about, you know, making ends meet and life. So I think the fact that what worries me about this is the severe pressure on fossil fuels and the severe pressure not to invest in developed countries, I think might lead to a shortage sooner than we think.
Ken, real quick, what do you think the next big market risk is as we sit in Davos today?
Look, I just think markets are priced pretty much for perfection, and you don't have to know. This is something I've learned over many years. People spend too much time trying to predict the event. All you have to do is know that there probably will be one. I've learned you don't have to know what it is. You just have to know that one will happen.
This year?
It may be this year. But look, I was saying today, if Lehman Brothers had made it through that one market, that one year, they'd probably be a $150 billion market cap company today. So you can't get taken out. You have to know that risk is possible, and you have to plan for it. And but you don't know exactly what the risk is. You just have to know you can survive it.
Ken, thank you so much for joining us.
Here's the evident idea. You can talk all you want up a happy valley in Switzerland. You got to go out there and do it. And if you do it, you've got to move it. And the obvious, most visible thing out there to move it is something four Liverpool football fields long. And what, is it truly a football field wide?
Think, are you speaking of the Maersk Triple E?
This would be the boat. The boats, the ships that move all this stuff around. To me, the most articulate voice on this in shipping and the serious idea of climate change and the logistics and trade of the world is Mr. Skou of Maersk. The Chief Executive Officer, Soren Skou, joins us. Now, we talk often in London. Thrilled to have you here. How do you respond to the visible elites of climate change who don't realize you've got to get the boxes in Asia from point A to point B?
Well, first, I always say that shipping is actually the most environmentally free, environmentally way of moving any type of goods. So the CO2 emission that we have per any ton of good moved is quite low compared to road and rail and air. But we still take on the challenge of wanting to reduce our CO2 footprint. And we have articulated more than a year ago an ambition to get to zero CO2 by 2050. And we have solid plans for how to get.
How do you plan to do that? Talk to us about those plans.
Well, we want to find it. I mean, the obvious is we need to find a different kind of fuel. And we believe that we have fuels that are probable, alcohols, ammonia, biomethane that can be produced from alternative sources.
This is important because it's about the fuel and not about the ship. because you're in a really, really tough spot. You have to plan a decade, multi-decades ahead from where you are right now. So it's not as simple as saying we're going to build a whole load of new ships. Walk me through the strategic thinking around issues like that.
Well, we believe, first of all, that we have a responsibility as a leader in the industry to drive the agenda. Secondly, as you say, we own assets that have a 25-year lifespan. I cannot be caught up by a regulation that tells me to do something completely different when we operate more than 700 ships. So we need to think ahead.
You are front and center in this new world. Some would suggest that President Trump has moved aggressively from a multilateral Maersk world where trade gets done to some form of bilateral world or almost a mercantile system. How is your business changed with not the trade war, but the many trades war, the new trade dynamic? How's it changed?
Well, clearly, growth is down. Up to the financial crisis, 25 years leading up to the financial crisis 10 years ago, trade was growing 7, 8, 9, 10% per year, trade liberalization and so on. And since then, we have seen much lower levels of growth. And in last year, we believe probably the numbers, when they're all said and done, will come in at slightly less than 2% growth. It's a very low number.
You expect that to pick up? You're seeing improving business in the new year?
I don't think that we'll see much higher trade growth.
It's just going to stay the same?
Yes.
Despite the fact that we have some kind of trade truce between the United States and China?
What we see in our numbers based on the commodities that are being shipped is that actually all of the consumer goods are holding up quite fine across the world. It's the capital goods that are not moving, and that's because business leaders like myself are worried about the future and we invest less.
In your Denmark, and folks, I want to make clear, Denmark is the space of economics of geography in the world. It's the best academics on this that there is. There is the geography of the South China Sea, of Singapore, of Indonesia, and that romantic strait that you got to get your boats through that strait at night at any time. That must be extraordinary. Give us an update on the ability to move Maersk ships from point A to point B in the South China Sea in the Pacific.
Today we are seeing no impediments or any restrictions or anything that we need to be concerned about. You're right, the Malacca Strait between Singapore and Indonesia is a very narrow channel, but as of today, we don't see any problems there.
You said trade is basically where it was last year. Don't really see it improving. Let's talk about rates, container rates. You're speaking to your big clients. What have they said so far? What do rates look like and how are things going to evolve in a year ahead?
Freight rates have gone up quite substantially since the 1st of October last year, mainly because we have switched over to a cleaner fuel on the 1st of January, and we're passing that on to the customers.
Well, let's cut to the chase. We have to make some news here. How do your customers receive the new invoice?
Well, it's always a procurement discussion, but at the end of the day, I believe that many, many, many of our customers recognize that it's good for everybody that we go to a cleaner fuel.
Quick final question, just before we let you go. If we can get the Maersk stock out there for people to have a look at, and for our listeners on radio, I'm going to tell you, it is several digits long. Some people always ask me, when are they going to do a stock split? When will Maersk do a stock split? This is getting ridiculous now. Are you going to do a stock split?
I can just say we don't have any plans to do a stock split.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Søren Skou of Maersk, the CEO. Look at the numbers. Hey, for our listeners on radio, several digits long in Danish kroner.
We can do digits on radio. That works.
Søren Skou,
thank you so much.
About his plans for the future. The President of the United States just pulling a pin and lobbing a grenade into this conference yesterday, and it was a total 180 from what we thought we heard from the administration the day before. We can get real reaction from Europe now with Mark Rutte, the Dutch Prime Minister. Prime Minister, great to see you.
Good to see you again.
Your annual visit with Tom and myself. It's great to see you. How do you respond to the President of the United States?
Positively, because he also had a very successful meeting with Ursula von der Leyen. She is the new EU Commission President. They agreed that it was a good meeting, that they will continue the dialogue as soon as possible. I've had myself many conversations with Trump on trade. I always found him very pragmatic and very practical. He has his irritations about Europe. We have some issues with the US, but that is not a problem. That's why you have to negotiate. I think we can get a deal done.
I wonder if you're more annoyed with France than you are the United States at the moment, because it's the policies of France that are causing much of the problem. Secretary Mnuchin said the following this week: if people want to just arbitrarily put taxes on our digital companies, we will consider arbitrarily putting taxes on car companies.
Yeah, but that is a discussion about digital tax. I think best will be to deal with the issue of digital tax in the context of the OECD. It can also be part of the talks between the US and Europe. But don't forget, the US is the number one economy in the world and the most powerful country. But in terms of overall economic size, Europe is bigger. We are 1.5 times the size of the US. So when they deal with China, it's not about first place, it's about second
place. But Prime Minister, you bring up a key point. Montana has the same voice in President Trump as Mississippi. There are many voices of Europe. What is the most efficacious way for Europe to speak to the President of the United States on trade?
Directly. And forthright. With Trump, you have
out
to be
Brussels
very clear.
Out of Brussels and out of Strasbourg. I mean, who's the voice that's going to sit across the table from the President
of the United States? That is the President of the European Commission, because this is a European thing. And we are united in the European Union on trade. We always have. One of the few very successful things we are doing. I mean, we have very many issues in Europe about climate change, about migration. But one of the consistently successful things we are dealing with as a European Union is trade. And we have to work with one voice. We are doing that also with the UK when they are leaving from next week onwards. We have to create a new trade deal. So I'm optimistic about it because we know what is important for Trump. We know what is important for Europe. And we are both pragmatical.
Well, there's some easy things to do.
And the rhetoric in the run-up is always part of that.
There are some easy things to do. One of them is just look at the tariffs on autos. If you import a car out of the United States into Europe, 10%. If you import a passenger car out of Europe into the United States, the tariff is 2.5%.
Yeah, but
now,
on SUVs, it's 25%.
Trucks are much higher, 25%, exactly. Which goes back decades.
So on average,
Can we address this? Yeah, can we just equalise the whole thing?
Well, I discussed that with Trump myself, and on average, it is about 9% from a car coming out of Europe. The 2.5, 25 put together is about 9%, and a car coming out of the US is 10%. So it is already almost the same. This is not a big issue. I think we can deal with this.
As I've asked before this morning, I want you to identify what the new capitalism will be for Europe. The Dutch have led on capitalism for well in excess of 400 years as well. Do you sense with the solution of Brexit, do you sense with some form of trade agreement with the United States, a less multilateral approach, that there has to be a new capitalism out of Europe, a new attitude?
Not a new capitalism, but we have to learn from the past. Dutch companies like Shell, Unilever, Philips, Axo, they always were both successful internationally oriented companies, but also very much rooted in the local communities in the countries which they were serving. And they still are. I'm still very proud of these companies. Some of the companies recently coming into place have less of a connection to the local communities, do not fully realize that next to making a nice profit, there is also a societal impact as a company. And the good you can do in terms of making sure that the changes to the environment are not taking place and the role you can play there. And I believe you should put more emphasis on that.
As John mentions, the French and the challenges Mr. Macron has domestically, or the transition of power after the Merkel era in Germany, what part can the Netherlands play to provide a center to Europe, a more coalescing capitalism?
Well, we believe that with the UK leaving, we're one of the countries with the most international outlook, the most trade-oriented, the most free enterprise-oriented countries. We work very closely together with the Scandinavian EU countries, with the Baltic countries, Slovenia, with Ireland, but also with Belgium and Luxembourg within the Benelux. That is a powerful group of countries who all share this outlook on capitalism, on international trade. At the same time, we have a strong bilateral relationship with Germany, with France. Right. I was last week in Italy. We are building a strong relationship with the Italian government, a bilateral relationship within the EU, because this is needed to maintain that outlook on the world with the UK leaving.
We're pushed for time. Let's get the UK leaving into the conversation. You're very pragmatic, in fact, respectful of the US administration, and that's encouraging about ultimately coming to a positive outcome with the United States. Are you equally the same with the UK at the moment?
Well, I have one worry. And
what
is that? The time we have available, because they will leave formally next week, but basically they won't leave at all. They will only leave the political structures. Yep. They will still be part of everything else in the EU till the end of the year. And in the meantime, we have to solve this trade deal. But for this trade deal to be solved, we need to agree on level playing field and all the other issues. It's an awfully short amount of time. So I hope that coming next summer, June, July, that Boris Johnson will at least contemplate extending, if necessary, this transition phase.
At the moment, he's not.
At the moment, he's not. But also here, I would say, let's take this step by step.
So you're just saying it's inconceivable that you can come to the trade agreement?
Not inconceivable, but it's very difficult. So, and there's still the risk, in the worst case, that you have a cliff edge scenario, like we had experienced last year.
This is a nightmare scenario. Because what we're going to end up with at Heathrow is Virgil van Dijk is not going to be able to go through customs like he can now. Yeah. I mean, let's bring it, the gentleman from Breda and Groningen, he's got to get up to Liverpool, and there he is stuck at Heathrow in a new customs
that is
line.
Unacceptable.
Unacceptable.
That's unacceptable. Right? He will return to the Netherlands.
For our US audience, can we explain who Virgil van Dijk is?
Well, I know who he is because I've been lectured
to. The greatest centre-back in football at the moment.
One of the great players in the Dutch
world.
Team.
Absolutely
and the
fantastic.
Reason why we will win the European Championship.
You think you're going to win?
Absolutely. No
really?
Doubt. No doubt.
A couple of injuries. Not worried at all.
That's also part of it. And they hopefully will be back in time.
This goes to the... we're going to have to talk about this later on the Dutch Prime Minister's next visit to New York and London.
We'll I just love that we have the Dutch discussion. Prime Minister with us and we end up talking about your favourite topic.
I love watching... He's like Aaron Judge of the New York Yankees. He's out of body.
Fantastic. He's something else. Mark Rutte, great to catch up with you once again.
Good to be here.
The Dutch Prime Minister in Davos.
He doesn't wait in line
at the World Economic Forum.
Prime Minister does not wait in line.
Well, he goes through that special lane, doesn't he?
When I travel privately, I wait in line.
Goes through that
when I would travel through Boris Johnson official capacity, I would be, well, hoovered around. But in a private capacity, I have to wait in the same line as you.
Pharaoh's the gig is...
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more. Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
With us for a good conversation of international finance, but also strength of the emerging markets and some of the weaknesses, is the chief executive of Standard Chartered. He's Bill Winters, as always. Thank you so much for joining us. We, every time quiz you on Hong Kong, and whether you've seen money flows, wealthy clients wanting to move their bank accounts out, give us an update on that.
Yeah, first of all, nice to be here. Hong Kong's in good shape, right? I mean, it was a horrific 6 months and culminating in a really horrific period of violence in December. But while the issues are as yet unresolved, and we know that, so the idea that this is behind us would be hopeful but naive. But peace is prevailing in Hong Kong, and that's very encouraging. So what we saw through the worst of the period was some people, very few on a percentage basis, made some provisions to move their money someplace else, opening an account someplace. But virtually none of them actually moved their money. So the business activity has stayed very strong in Hong Kong. So as Hong Kong as a trading hub, Hong Kong is a financial center, and we see it from the IPO calendars, and is very strong. And they haven't missed a beat in that regard. The hospitality, the retail sectors, tourism have been severely impacted. Obviously, a big chunk of the tourism came from mainland China. It will take a while for them to come back. They had a bad experience when they were in Hong Kong. And the rest of the world has stayed away while things were unsettled. Now that peace is breaking out, as it persists, as we hope it does, I think Hong Kong will get back to normal over the course of this year.
Moments ago, China has taken steps to actually cancel some of the lunar festivities, because of the coronavirus. Yeah. As a big chief executive in the region, how do you monitor and how do you prepare for it?
Well, it's concerning. I mean, we first start by making sure that our own colleagues are taking the proper precautions and safe. So you can imagine the level of anxiety is very, very high. If somebody gets a cold now, there's a question whether something much worse, and that can cause the whole office to lock down. So that's we start at home. Mm-hmm. We're trying to stay very close to our clients, help them understand what their exposures are. Obviously, people in the transportation and tourism industry themselves are at some risk within China, especially coming into Chinese New Year. Trying to help identify working capital needs or challenges that will come up if things progress as they have over the past 24 hours. Other than that, we're watching with the rest of the world and hoping.
But do you have operations that could be directly affected?
Yeah, we do. I was intending to be in Wuhan next week. We have a very substantial operation in Wuhan and Chongqing and Xi'an, all through Western China. And so they're directly affected.
So are you speaking with health officials on the ground there, or who are you?
My colleagues in China are speaking with health officials continuously. But as you've seen and as you've reported, it's a very fast moving set of facts. I mean, even today we've had material new pieces of news. But we have our own intelligence on the ground as well from our clients and from our people, and it's very consistent with what we're hearing from the government. So, and I'm encouraged by this commitment to transparency. I could only encourage it to continue.
Are you encouraged by U.S.-China Phase 1 deal, or actually is Phase 1 nothing, because it's simply an understanding that things won't escalate for now?
No, it's encouraging because they demonstrated that they can agree on something. And it has stopped a cycle of escalation. That's a good thing. There's a bit of clawback in terms of tariffs and protection of intellectual properties and opening up the financial services markets. These are all good things. Does it solve the problem? No, of course not. The structural issues are still there. But the fact that the two sides have demonstrated a willingness to agree on some things, we have to take as encouraging.
But does it help Standard Chartered?
With the tariffs going up, there was no particular impact on Standard Chartered, so coming down there won't be either. What's challenging is the prospect, the uncertainty around this prospect of a bifurcated world, with our customers and our clients not really knowing how much they have to reconfigure their supply chains. And if you don't know what you need to do, you tend to prepare for the worst, which usually means a lot of wasted cost and investment. So the increasing uncertainty was a problem. Mm-hmm. It's come off a little bit, but the uncertainty hasn't improved too much.
President Trump was here yesterday. He spoke to a number of business leaders. I think you were in some of those meetings. Mm. What was the message coming from the U.S. administration?
The key message I took away from the messages was that he's running for president of the United States. So the message would seem to be quite targeted at the domestic audience. I'd say that the themes in Davos have overwhelmingly been sustainability. I mean, to the point that it's probably crowded out some other very important discussions like the challenges around inequality. But the traction on sustainability has been very impressive, I think. So hardcore commitments in terms of the metrics that we'll be using to measure progress. And I say specifically, what does my business contribute to this climate change dynamic? And what can I do about it? And then specific commitments from corporations and a willingness, I know, across the banking industry. I was chairing a session yesterday where we focused a lot on what the banks could do collectively to address the sustainability question. So, those are the messages coming out of Davos. And then there was some noise on the side.
Okay, if you look at markets, what is the one thing? We had geopolitical concerns, regarding Iran and Iraq. U.S.-China trade is still at the forefront. U.S. elections, which you kind of mentioned. Out of those three, what's the biggest risk for the markets?
I think the big structural risk, because it's very impactful and as yet unresolved, although in a peaceful zone right now, is the U.S.-China tensions. Iraq, Iran, U.S., Saudi has the possibility to explode. Right now, that feels unlikely. I mean, it feels like there's been a dramatic escalation and then quick de-escalation. And certainly what I can pick up through the hallways, and it's just, I think everybody's got their views, there's a genuine willingness on all sides to try to de-escalate at this point. So, but of course, if that changed and it impacted oil flows through the straits, then we'd be in a very different place. To me, it still comes back to U.S.-China and getting some real progress there.
We're moments away from the ECB decision. Are central banks exhausted? Are they running out of ammunition?
I don't think they're running out of ammunition, but I think the ammunition is a little bit less effective. So, I mean, of course, there's new rounds of quantitative easing, or there's new types of assets that central banks could buy to affect credit spreads or even affect equity prices at a point. But it seems to be an exercise with diminishing returns. So I don't think they're out of tools by any means, but they might have to use more of those tools if they feel the need to use those tools at all.
Right, but we've heard President Lagarde of the ECB trying to put pressure on fiscal. If you were to quantify 2020, if we had one monetary policy or one fiscal policy, would it be government spending more? And does that actually give you more business?
No, if there's a lesson that we've learned from developing markets through the years, it's aggressive fiscal programs targeted at things that really improve the quality of an economy, so infrastructure, education, healthcare, those things are typically a really good use of money, especially when you're funding it with very low cost debt, which is what we have right now. Fiscal deficits that are being used to drive consumption give you a sugar high, but don't structurally improve the ability of the economy to grow and strengthen. So, I think to the extent that the U.S. and Germany, so the two guys with the biggest fiscal firepower right now, step up their fiscal spending, but focus on these structural value creators, that could be a very important complement to monetary policy.
But there's a little noise that actually Germany is ready to spend what a lot of people ask of them.
Well, they're under a lot of pressure. I don't know if they've internalized that yet.
Okay, the negative rates, how much of, I mean, every bank is complaining about negative rates.
Yeah.
But actually, do policymakers understand that this could not only lead to really testing the banking models even further, but actually social, like, unrest?
I think policymakers have to be very careful about what they say, but I can't imagine that they don't know that it's not just bad for the banking system. It's very bad in terms of creating imbalances in the economy and imbalances in capital markets, that when they unwind, it could be quite dangerous. And since it's clearly part of the central bank's mandate is financial stability, they know that this is another kind of drug that is also having diminishing returns and that is piling up quite a substantial problem for the future.
Yeah. Very quickly on your turnaround plan, is it time to say mission accomplished?
I never say mission accomplished, and it's not accomplished. But what I can say is that our bank is super strong at this point. We have all the foundations that we need. We have all the growth momentum in the key areas of our cross-border corporate business, our affluent client business, and then more recently our massive investments in digital mm-hmm. banking. All those things are working extremely well. We just have to see them through to fruition.
Bill Winters, as always, thank you so much for joining us. He's the Chief Executive of Standard Chartered.
Stacey Cunningham joins us. She's gone a little bit better than internship as president of the New York Stock Exchange. We are thrilled to have you here.
Thanks, Tom. It was the American dream.
It is. It was when you were a kid in a financial family, that was like, because what was it like the first day when you were an intern on the floor of the exchange?
So I actually, before I walked onto the stock exchange floor, I never thought about finance. It wasn't something I wanted to do. But those first minutes, the first 15 minutes, I knew it was what I wanted to do with my life. I loved it. I loved the pace. And I love the energy, and you know, I love what capitalism delivers for this country. And I think that's what we should be talking about, because I think that's where we need a little bit of a tune-up.
Do you think anyone is defending capitalism at this conference?
Well, no, and that's the point. I think what I'm hearing at this conference is we have to tell our stories better. And I think capitalism is not immune from that,
yeah.
Right? Capitalism has been the engine that has been the growth of really fueling the growth of the United States. But it needs a tune-up. We need to make sure that
right.
The American dream is a story of shared success. And so we got to get companies out from private to public sooner so that others can share in their wealth creation. And we need to talk about the good that those companies are doing by creating jobs and giving back to their communities.
One of the great voices of the NYSE is a guy named Ken Polcari. He's been great, loyal, visible, smart on the markets. Great. He and I remember another time. Is the New York Stock Exchange of today anything like what you knew as an intern? And where's it going to be in 5 years?
Yeah, we kept the best parts of the New York Stock Exchange, and we brought together modernization where we could automate the parts that really just should be automated. And so we really believe strongly that the combination of people and technology is so much more powerful.
Are you keeping Arthur Levitt happy with Best Price?
Yes, yes.
Explain that for our audience. The folks on radio and television, this is wicked important. You hear Arthur Levitt, the former chairman of the SEC, with us on Bloomberg Surveillance, and he's always talking about the execution. Explain why the execution now is different than before Ken Polcari had a beard.
One of the things that you want to make sure is that when somebody wants to buy or sell a stock, they can go out and see what is the value. And nothing values a company better than the public markets. But price is an important part of that. And so the exchanges are the ones that set that price. And even though market trading has changed and 40% of the market is trading in dark and not contributing to that price, they're actually taking those prices that the exchange is set to determine where to trade. And those are the same exact prices that a retail investor logging into their Fidelity, E-Trade, Ameritrade.
You just slipped through trading in the dark.
Yeah.
You trade in the dark.
What is trading in the dark? That's jargon.
Trading,
we don't do jargon here.
So what that is if you are showing your prices to the world to see,
yeah.
So that when someone logs into their online trading account
on their
or
Bloomberg.
Calls their broker on their Bloomberg terminal
yes, thank you.
And they get their prices, their Bloomberg terminal is showing the best price in the market.
Stacey, you're making the argument that companies should stop staying in private markets for so long and come public.
Yes.
A lot of people would understand that argument coming from you. Why? and why a direct listing is going to be such an important part of this process?
So the two great questions. The first one is, why should they be public sooner? And there are a lot of conversations around why they're staying private longer. And you can talk about that. It's capital, it's regulation, it's all these things. But with the downsides to the fact that they're staying private means there's less discipline and governance in companies, which at a much larger company, that's much more impactful. There's less clarity around valuation. So are these companies worth what the private markets are saying? Or do you need the wisdom and the disclosures and transparency of the public markets to determine that? And it's creating a bifurcation of wealth.
Let's talk about pressure, the pressure on you guys at the moment. We've had the likes of Larry Fink of BlackRock talk about leaning on the active management world to lean out of some companies, let's say, in coal. The pressure really is going to have to be put on the index providers to say to them, you need to get these companies off out of the index. That's going to make the most difference. The pressure is also going to be on the exchanges. Why allow these companies to list on your exchange?
I think it's really important to make sure that investors have access to opportunities and the right to choose. And so by putting them on exchanges and giving them information about their disclosures is helpful for that they can make informed decisions. I think it's really important to recognize what the conversations I've been having here in Davos over the past few days are from many CEOs who are saying, we've been doing all of the work around ESG already because it's important to our employees. It's important to our customers that we take a stand on these issues, even more so than their investors.
So Stacey, let me ask you this, because I imagine it's come up multiple times, not just at this conference, but over the last few months, maybe the last few years as well. You have minimum standards to be listed on the New York Stock Exchange, minimum market cap, minimum amount of shareholders as well. Why not have ESG as part of that?
Because our standards are very focused on investor protections. And if those companies stay private, the conversations we're having are really connected, right? If we put so many standards around requirements for companies to be public, they have alternatives. It's a different dynamic than it was years ago when you actually had to come to the public markets to get money. Because there is money available in the private market space, we don't want investors to be denied those opportunities entirely.
This is not your remit, but I want your opinion on this because it's important. Farrow has just recovered from the shock of losing that much money on his 8,000 shares of Uber that he bought.
Don't listen to this.
How do you respond when on your floor they do the song and dance of an IPO or even a secondary, but particularly initial public offerings, and they come out and they do the whole modern media dance and the thing goes down X percent? That's not good for the brand, is it?
I think we should keep in mind that in a large IPO like that, they sold $8 billion worth of stock, and it opened at a price and stayed right there. Now, over time, investors were reacting to the valuation of companies, and as companies go
public,
that's
what happens. Your job is to get it open in the early minutes.
And to make sure that investors have the information.
Did they have the information on those transactions?
Yes, and you'll see, it's a great example of private valuations versus public valuations. And so we need to actually make sure companies get out. And this shift, because they don't need capital, is actually why the direct listing was an innovation that we delivered this year, because it's actually not about raising money. It's about, in those cases.
Stacey, you're nailing. There's a private valuation. They go public and selected stocks tank. Whose responsibility is that? It's not you. Who is it? Who's responsible
for that
better pricing?
I think investors are asking questions that they weren't asking before, and I think that's what you're going to see in 2020, is that investors are asking about profitability and valuations. And when you have limited people participating in the private space, you're limiting access to opportunity, and you're also limiting access to information.
Stacey. Yeah. Fantastic conversation.
One of my kids needs a job as an intern this summer. Can we work on that?
Are you looking for work? Stacey Cunningham, NYSE president. Thank you very much. From Davos, Switzerland, for our audience worldwide, alongside Tom Keane, I'm Jonathan Ferrow. This is the Countdown to the Open on Bloomberg TV and on Bloomberg Radio. I can confirm that in Frankfurt, Germany, there is an absolute snoozer of a news conference taking place.
Snoozer, and what's great is
President Christine Lagarde.
Everybody asking questions is asking one, two, three in a row. I don't know how she does it.
If you would like to follow that, you can on the Bloomberg Terminal if you are a Bloomberg subscriber on Live Go. Let's get to price action. Around about 20 minutes out from the opening bell in New York City, we set up as follows. The pain, the epicenter of all of it, is over in Asia. Chinese equity markets down and down hard. In the United States, barely any follow-through whatsoever. S&P 500 futures coming in just a tenth of 1%. In the bond market, yields lower by 3 basis points, Tom. 174 is your yield on a U.S. 10-year.
What's interesting in all of our discussions here, and you learn this in Davos, and frankly, you learn it on the island of Manhattan as well, that each bank is different, each executive and different set of executives at the banks are different, and of course, all different challenges. At Goldman Sachs, of course, the transition, and they've chosen a guy that used to move ice cream at Baskin Robbins. This is important
training.
Are you training.
Trying to cause trouble?
John, you don't understand
Straight
this. In America,
interview.
The coveted job in high school, younger high school.
Is that right?
You went to McDonald's, you went to the others. The glory job was Baskin Robbins ice cream.
The ice cream
and
man?
And that's how you moved ahead.
David Solomon, Goldman Sachs chairman and CEO. Have you ever had an introduction like that before?
First of all, thank you for having me,
it's
but
great
I've,
to
never,
have you here.
I've never had an
What was your favorite
before.
Flavor?
My favorite flavor was Rocky Road.
Okay, there we go.
What was your favorite flavor?
An introduction
Pistachio.
Okay, always. I'm not taking part, guys. Central banks, the epicenter of the conversation today with the ECB in Frankfurt. For the Federal Reserve, real conversation about what is going on with the balance sheet, David. Would love your insight. Just your take your opinion. Is that QE or is that not QE? What is that?
So the monetary policy that's been around and has been in place for a long time obviously has been an enormous stimulus. When we sit here today and I kind of think about, you know, the path forward, I think we're now in a period this year after three mid-cycle cuts, for lack of a better term, that I don't expect a lot from the Fed in the context of this year. Obviously, the balance sheet's come down a lot over the course of the last couple of years. All of this supports or impacts liquidity in markets. And I think the Fed has done a reasonable job managing liquidity in markets, even with a speed bump back.
So I'll ask it again then. Is that QE as they start to buy T-bills and a balance sheet starts to expand again?
Anytime the Fed uses its resources to affect liquidity in some way, shape, or form, it's having an impact on markets. I'm not going to answer the question the way you're looking for me to answer it, because I don't think it's a black and white answer. You tell me what QE is.
We'll ask Jan Hatzius, we'll ask Bill Dudley, but the answer here is we get a lot of different opinions, including the former member of Goldman Sachs, really someone that drove your economics forward, Mr. Dudley of the New York Fed. We get all these different opinions, and what our audience wants to know is what you have learned from your pros on the desk of those reactions, the movements that you've seen in the short-term paper market. What have you actually observed in the market that gives you information about these balance sheet challenges?
Well, I think that everyone observed that the Fed had a very, very significant balance sheet investment and it reduced that balance sheet. There have been a bunch of regulatory inputs, the amount of liquidity that banks need to hold
right.
as the regulations have changed. And at some point, you can reach a supply demand where, for a variety of reasons, some of them can be idiosyncratic around
right.
a moment in time, maybe tax payments, that the supply demand of liquidity changes and the price for short-term liquidity rises. And we saw that. The Fed responded appropriately by saying we want to make sure that there's enough liquidity in the system. I think all the banks also, I know we did, I can't speak for others, we positioned ourselves so at the end of the year
right.
when we thought liquidity might be tight, we have liquidity to contribute to that.
Delicate question. Are you constrained by the new set of regulations? Are you happy with them? Or do you need to see amendments so you do finance better?
No, we are an adapter to the regulatory framework. And so I think as an organization, we've adapted very well over the decade to the regulatory framework. And look, the regulatory framework continues to evolve. And so our job is to make sure we can serve our clients well, that we have the right resources, and we do not feel constrained to serve our clients well and run our business based on the regulatory framework.
We want your take on the markets and the price action we've seen over the last couple of months. The community, the investment community at the World Economic Forum, pretty polarized on what we're seeing at the moment. We've had a whole range of views. We had Guggenheim Scott Minard say that it resembles some
World's
of the Ponzi
coming
scheme.
To an end.
We had Bob Prince of Bridgewater say that the boom bust cycle as we know it is over. Where do you come down on those two extreme views?
Generally not a man of extremes. So I'd say that there will be booms and busts again at some point, although I don't see one anytime soon. And as I've been around talking to clients over the last few days, and that's one of the principal things I do while I'm here, you know, I'd say I see and I hear what I'd call kind of a confident, middle-of-the-road view of the current economic environment. U.S. economy is in good shape. Manufacturing sector is a little bit soft. Capital spending has been lower than people would like to see, but the consumer
right.
is overcompensating for that. Europe, a little bit better. Headwinds of the phase one deal helps a little. But in the distribution of outcomes, overwhelming okay. likely scenario is economy chugs along this
well year. Said. But the distributions of outcome, and I remember this from Mr. Varnier in August of 2007, you get a 3 standard or even 4.1 standard deviation moment. Is Goldman Sachs, and for that matter, your view of Global Wall Street, positioned better now boom, bust, if we get that jump condition, that abrupt movement, as we saw in August of 2007.
The banking system's positioned incredibly differently than it was positioned in 2007. There's been an enormous amount of leverage that's come out of the banking system. There's been a huge amount of equity that's gone into the banking system. I also think the risk management activities of the industry have improved materially. So there will be cycles, there will be events that stir markets. Generally, they repeat differently. So the last time there was a significant economic recession, it affected the banks significantly. I think the banks are in a different position.
Yep.
And when we do have, you know, trouble in the years ahead, which at some point we will, there are a range of things we can see, but I think the banks will be more resilient in the context of that based on the way they're currently capitalized.
Let's talk about how you're positioning the bank for the years to come.
Sure.
Investor Day. I believe it's next Wednesday.
Investor Day is next Wednesday.
Give us the teaser.
No, Investor Day is right now. Let's begin.
What are we looking for?
We can begin
next
right
Wednesday.
Now. But,
come on.
Investor Day is next Wednesday. It's our first Investor Day ever since we went public in 20 years. I'm a big believer that you know, our investors and more broadly our stakeholders, you know, deserve transparency around the way we're going to grow the organization, expand our franchise, serve our clients, and ultimately deliver higher returns for our shareholders. And so we'll lay out a series of initiatives, many of which we've spoken about, you know, individually publicly, but with more information, we'll put out some targets with respect to returns that we can be held accountable to.
What targets?
We're going to put out targets with respect to returns that we can be held accountable to. And we'll talk a little bit about how we intend to run the bank so we can deliver for shareholders over time.
Let me set up a scenario. Let's say a week before your investor meeting, a competitor comes out and says, our new profitability target is 15 to 70% return on equity. Does that make life a little bit difficult for you next week?
We're focused on running our business.
Of course.
I don't think anyone came out and said 15 to 70% return on equity. They said 15 to 70% return on tangible equity.
Okay.
But we're focused on our business. And so our returns and our messages are going to be rooted in what we want to do as an organization.
You don't think you'll be benchmarked against deliver, the competition?
Everybody's always benchmarked against competition.
That's why I asked the question.
We're going to deliver what we think we can deliver over time for our shareholders to build a better, bigger, stronger organization.
Part of the sell side grilling you on this investor day, and you've got a whole team on this and you've been very experienced as this, is they're going to talk about strategic vision. And so much of this on investor day is explaining to investors, do you want to expand through acquisition of a bank or just small bolt-on acquisitions that advance Goldman Sachs intellect and technology? What's your feeling on that right now, given the terrific equity markets of the last 12 months? Are you priced out of opportunities globally?
Well, I've said this repeatedly that I think, and I come to this from my own experience as a banker, I think anyone, any leadership team that's running a big organization always has to be aware of both organic opportunities to grow and also inorganic opportunities to grow. We're always looking and thinking about things that we think can expand our franchise and allow us to serve our clients more effectively and ultimately deliver for shareholders. But the bar for us to ever do something significant and organically is extremely high.
But on a strategic basis, is that a geographic choice? Obviously, it's a financial choice. But tell me about the Goldman Sachs geography right now. Is it a Europe vision?
Goldman Sachs is a global firm. I think one of our competitive advantages is we truly are a global platform in the businesses that we operate in. Historically, if you look at our investment banking business, if you look at our sales and trading business, you look at our asset management business, we are a global organization and we have an ability to operate anywhere in the
world.
David,
what's the strategy on wealth management right now? On Goldman Sachs asset management, what's the strategy right now?
So on wealth management or on asset management?
I'll take both, please.
Well, you asked one and then the other.
It's like Jeopardy. I'll take, you know, for two.
Let's start with asset management.
Please.
On asset management, we run one of the top three global active asset management platforms. It's an advisory-led business. In other words, we think our clients come to us because in addition to strong investment performance over a period of time, we package it around advice to help them meet their long-term investment needs. We think advice is differentiated and you can still get paid for advice. And that's what our asset management business focuses on. We're also very unique in that when you look at the three largest global asset management businesses, we may be the only one that really in every product category, including alternatives, is really at scale. And so, you know, across liquidity products, across active equity and fixed income across alternatives were at scale on a global basis. And I think for our institutional customers, that's an advantageous position. So when you look at our ability to acquire assets over the last 3 or 5 years, long-term fee-based assets, we've outperformed relative to people we'd be benchmarked against.
David, talk to us about how hard it is to make a strategic decision for the bank that will work over 10 years, not just for now. So 10 years ago, the right decision, some people might say, would be to beef up wealth management and scale back fixed income trading. 10 years later, that might be the right strategic place to be in. But as we sit here now, 10 years out, how hard is it to get that strategy right? To look forward and say, what works now might not work in the future?
Well, look, I think that's what CEOs always have to do. And I think the right CEOs make investments to ensure that the competitive position of their franchises strengthens over time. And when you get it right, your franchises strengthen. And if you don't get it right, you know, over time, you know, the evidence comes forward. So we are going to grow our asset management business. We are going to grow and expand our wealth management business. And we think over the next decade, those are opportunities that take core competencies at Goldman Sachs, and we can expand on them.
David, I want to talk about the sensitivities of the moment. And this comes out, I think, of William Cohan's book on Goldman Sachs. And there's that acclaimed scene at Scotty's over egg salad sandwich. And it's Mr. Weinberg and others that go down to Scotty's. And over lunch, they do Goldman Sachs business. This is a whole new world now. Tell us about the shift that you've had as a new chief executive officer. And this is Investor Day coming up. Tell us internally at Goldman Sachs the mood as you go to your first Investors Day. What's the day-to-day mix at Goldman Sachs right now as you move forward with your strategic plan?
Well, along with the rest of our leadership team, I'm very privileged. We're very privileged to lead an organization that's filled with extraordinary people. And I think they're excited about the Investor Day. But I also think the organization is energized by the momentum the firm has to serve our clients holistically through a program we call One Goldman Sachs to really make sure we're delivering as much as we can for our clients broadly. There's a real client service mindset in the organization that this leadership team is really, you know, pushing hard at making sure we get right. And when they look at the areas where we're investing, whether it's transaction banking, it's the alternatives business and asset management, it's the expansion of our wealth management opportunities, or it's our digital consumer banking platform, they're excited about the investments and excited about thinking about a Goldman Sachs where more of these businesses make us more impactful
in serving
our clients.
How new is that Goldman Sachs? It's not like Scotty's in the romance of egg salad sandwiches.
I don't remember.
No, this is a really important scene.
I read the book, but I don't remember the scene.
But this is an important scene of how Goldman Sachs operated within the mythology and legend of the company.
Well,
what's the new Goldman Sachs look like?
I can't speak to how Goldman Sachs operated historically. Going back that far, because I wasn't there.
Well, go back but 6 weeks.
today, look, we have a very, very young, vibrant workforce that's very focused on serving our clients. We're very, very focused on making sure we continue to have the best, the brightest, the most talented, motivated, driven people to serve our clients well. I think we're in that position. This management team leads with an open, communicative style. I think that's what the organization wants, and I feel like the organization's excited about the direction we're moving in, but we have a lot of work to do, and we have a lot to accomplish, and like any organization, we're focused and committed to getting that done.
How do you open up to the consumer at the same time maintain that Goldman Sachs gold-plated branding? Are there no concerns about that?
Look, we think a lot about our brand and our position, but at the same point, I think there is lots that we can do for consumers that makes our brand and our approach, especially on a digital platform, aspirational for consumers. And look, when you talk about consumers, there is a wide swath of people that you can deal with. And I feel good about the way our brand's received.
Well, how do you make it aspirational?
One of the big endorsements, I think, of our brand is that when we partnered with Apple around the credit card, they wanted Goldman Sachs on that credit card. And I think that speaks to how, you know, our brand, you know, is viewed by some out in the marketplace. Well, we want to find ways to use that brand effectively to serve individuals for their financial needs. And there's no reason, if we do it well, it's differentiated, we ease their pain points, we give them information and resources that allow them to make better decisions, that can't represent that brand with consumers in a very effective way.
Are you going to take technology at this Investors Day and drive it forward? Is there another announcement with Apple or someone else?
There's no big reveal.
I got to make some
publicly.
News, David. Help me. They're in my ear. Make some news.
You're not going to make a lot of news. We will talk about our technology investment. We have.
There we go.
Some new leaders, you know, outside. We'll talk a little bit about some of the technology investments we're making, like all financial services firms are making.
Yep.
We're excited about that. But I don't know that I'm going to help you make some great grand, you know, curtain-raising news. The Investor Day will come next Wednesday.
And I look forward to
your feedback.
This interview is so over.
Goldman Sachs, be great to catch up with you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keen. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success. It's discipline. It's teamwork. It's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. And it's why Stifel is one of the fastest growing global wealth management and investment banking firms in the industry. Stifel. It's where success meets success. Start your journey at stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.